While The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings share a continuous narrative focused on the great years of Middle-earth's late Third Age, for serious readers of Tolkien, the two works appear, in many respects, to be of entirely different literary genres. It's often noted that The Hobbit feels like more of a children's fairy tale, while The Lord of the Rings elevates the Baggins saga to the level of an ancient epic. Considering this, it's fascinating to note that despite The Hobbit's immense popularity, Tolkien was in many ways unsatisfied with it, especially in the way the tale had been told. Around 1960, he even went so far as to begin a complete rewrite of The Hobbit, a rewrite that, for better or for worse, never saw completion. Beginning with this episode, we will take a close look at the texts and notes associated with this effort, as contained in John Ratliff's The History of The Hobbit. The Tolkien Road, Episode 192, The Hobbit, The Lost Chapters, Part 1. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, episode 192, The Hobbit, The Lost Chapters, part one. Greta, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fantabulous.
Fantabulous?
Yeah.
Good.
How about you?
I'm good.
Wonderful.
I am keeping it real.
You know, it's all we can ever do.
It's all we can do. That's all we do.
You're absolutely right.
I said do.
You did.
Totally meant to do that.
Thank you for drawing that to my attention.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Special shout out to our patrons who mm-hmm. are awesome, and we always give you guys a shout out because you help in the biggest way make the Tolkien Road happen. And
Word.
We are very grateful for each and every one of you.
Yes.
If you are not a patron and would like to become one, head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road and don't forget to pledge $1 or more per episode. You can set a monthly limit when you do it. So yeah.
So you ain't going to go broke.
You ain't going to go broke. You can. I mean, we'll accept that. You know, if you want to give us all your money, we'll accept that. There is no limit to how much you can give that we impose, but you are allowed to self-impose limits
yep.
on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That self-impose on yourself. Yeah, it's redundant.
Right, yeah, that is very redundant. You're on a roll today.
I am. So, yeah, we appreciate your support, and we would really appreciate it if it would be amazing if everyone who listens to this podcast right now went and pledged $1 or more per episode. We might be able to just retire and do Tolkien stuff all the time if that were to happen.
Whoa.
So
That's amazing. Crazy to think about.
It's crazy to think about. And you get all kinds of awesomeness, and then we would be able to do all kinds of more awesomeness with Patreon and, you know, do cool things just for patrons. So, you know,
I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
But you guys, the power is in your hands. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
All right. Rate us on iTunes also. Rate us on iTunes. Please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us.
Yeah, please. Yeah,
please do. That helps get the word out about it. And we'd love to hear from you at TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com or via the website, TolkienRoad.com. You can comment on past episodes, current episodes. If you comment on an episode from, I think, you know, all our episodes are up there. So if you find an episode from, you know, back when we did the Silmarillion or something like that, and you had something you wanted to say about that, but you didn't start listening until well after we were past that, go back, leave us a comment there, and we're going to start incorporating those comments, the good comments into our, you know, listener feedback that we share on the episode. So, in fact, we're going to do that with some comments today. So why are you smiling
I thought it was funny that you felt the need to clarify good comments. Like, only the good ones.
Well, we're not going to read spam comments.
If it's worthless.
We're not going to read spam comments.
Okay.
So
spam or, like, robot kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay. And like, we appreciate, like, just saying hey and everything, but, like, you know,
yeah,
probably may not read that on the podcast. You're just like, hey-o!
I see what you're getting at. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I didn't mean to be, like,
it
a jerk
just,
about it. But
no, you weren't. I was just, anyway.
Good as always. Making me feel like a jerk, I swear. People write
job.
In, they're like listening to past episodes, and they're like, man, you're such a jerk to Greta. And I'm like, you don't understand. Like, right, when we get offline, Greta is like, she is such a jerk to me.
Oh,
this is my one chance
fallacies.
To give it back because I know that she wants to present this image to the world that's a complete and utter lie.
So many
about
falsehoods.
Who she is.
So many.
So
don't listen.
Anyway, okay. Speakpipe. Hey, where, what do you guys like? Why aren't you speakpiping us? We want to hear your voices. We want to hear your beautiful, sonorous voices.
Especially now. We know you guys are at home. Come on. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Speakpipe.
Speakpipe.
All right. Okay. Hey, announcement. So my new video series is on YouTube. It's an 8-part guide to the Silmarillion. I just put up video number 6 a couple days ago. And head on over there. Check them out. It features beautiful artwork from a number of different artists. And these videos are designed to give you the basics for a good first-time read of the Silmarillion. So you might just enjoy them. Even if you've read the Silmarillion already, you might just enjoy them anyway. You probably would, actually, because the artwork is really cool. And I just got to say, like, my narration and everything is magnificent. So
yeah,
it's, you know, do yourself a flavor and go over there and subscribe. Watch these videos, subscribe, and, you know, get yourself alerted every time there's a new video posted. Because I'm going to be trying to do more of these going forward. I've had fun making this series, and I'm planning on doing more videos, like shorter videos like that over on YouTube. All right. So just to let you all know what the plan is going forward, we are beginning probably what's going to end up being, I think I kind of been mapping it out before I began this episode, and I think what we're going to do is we're going to do 4 parts on this topic, the Lost Chapters from The Hobbit, or of The Hobbit. And I think that makes the most sense in dealing with them, because there's a lot of stuff to explore in these. We want to make sure we give them the time and attention that they deserve, because they're really fascinating. They're super fascinating. So today we are going to kick it off, and we're going to kind of talk about the background and what these are, why they're important, where they came from, all those sorts of things. And then we're going to look at the detail of each of the sections that are, you know, that I apply this label, the Lost Chapters, to. So we'll begin on that in just a second. After we get through with this episode, we're probably going to get back to Unfinished Tales, talk some more about the Third Age, do some more with the history of the Third Age, as in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings. Just a lot of stuff in the Third Age that I don't know about and would love to learn more about. So that's
cool.
The plan.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So yeah, Stick with us. All right. So The Hobbit, The Lost Chapters. All right, Greta.
Mm-hmm.
You, I gave you a pass, actually, on reading this, because this is, like, I know we've talked about, like, the readings from Unfinished Tales are a little bit complex to read. They can be a little mm-hmm. confusing.
Yeah.
Because there's, like, there's, like, triple nested narratives.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then you've got, like, these, like, asides that are notes and everything, and so it can get really confusing. And this is even more like that, because this is from a book called The History of the Hobbit, which is written by John Ratliff. And so I just needed to spend some time with it, mm-hmm. and I'm going to kind of give you the background. And okay. But feel free to ask any questions along the way, right, to help clarify, to make sure that that kind of the background I'm giving is clear, is abundantly clear.
Got it.
Does that work?
Yeah, that's all perfect.
Right. So, yeah. What we're going to be covering today is from John Ratliff's The History of the Hobbit, which came out in the early 2000s, and it is exactly what it says, right? It's kind of like, you know, Christopher Tolkien compiled this huge history of the history of Middle Earth, and it gives all these, like, notes and lost writings and all these sorts of things, incomplete drafts, unfinished tales. I mean, really, The History of Middle Earth was kind of like a continuation of the Unfinished Tales project, right?
Yeah.
So the History of the Hobbit is similar to that. John Ratliff went through, and he went from the very beginning and told the story of how the Hobbit came to be
mm-hmm.
in the first place, and then he kind of went beyond that and said, how did the second edition come to be? How did the third edition come to be? Wow. And here's all this other interesting information that you may not have known before, right, about okay. it. So it's a very, like, thorough take on the Hobbit, especially from a textual history perspective, right? How did the story develop over time? Okay.
Yeah.
And as you know from past discussions on The Hobbit, as most readers know it, would know it today,
mm-hmm.
is not The Hobbit as it was originally published in 1937, right? The original 1937 edition of The Hobbit was in a couple of chapters was very different, especially in the chapter concerning Gollum. Right, the chapter that had to do with Gollum in the original one. Right, we talked some about how Tolkien had to change the interaction of Bilbo and Gollum some in order to bring it into line with his intentions for the Lord of the Rings, right?
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
when they mm-hmm. published the second edition, sometime in the, I think it was right around the time the Lord of the Rings came out, he had made a bunch of revisions to, especially to different parts of the text, but mainly focused on Bilbo's interaction with Gollum, okay. right?
Yep.
So this is expanding on that, and that's incorporated into this, but the history of the Hobbit focuses on the story of the development of the Hobbit over time into from its infancy, you know, riding down in the hole in the ground there lived the Hobbit, all the way through to the last revisions he made in 1966. But what we're gonna focus on is what's called Phase 5, which is labeled in the book the 1960 Hobbit.
Okay.
So let me give you a little background on the phases. All right. So phases one through, and this is Ratliff's own sort of way of dividing these things up and understanding them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So phases one through three in Ratliff's book focus on the original composition of The Hobbit in its first edition, right?
Okay.
So like phase one is like, what's the story, you know, the famous myth, like kind of story of Tolkien was grading exams one day, probably maybe in the 20s, and there was a blank piece of paper and he was really thankful for it. He was bored to death from grading, which I completely get from grading, you know, when I grade papers for the classes I teach. He was just bored to death, and so he just popped into his mind, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, and he wrote it down, and he didn't really think much more of it
mm-hmm.
at that point until much later, and you know, the rest is history.
Right. Yep.
But phase one through three covers that history, right? Phase one through three covers the story of how the Hobbit came to be in the first place.
Okay.
All the way to publication in 1937.
Got it.
Okay. Phase four was the project of harmonizing the Hobbit with the Lord of the Rings that resulted in the Hobbit second edition in 1951, right?
Okay. So that's the revisions with Gollum and
exactly. So,
like that, yeah.
So as Tolkien began writing what was then called The New Hobbit, which we now know as Lord of the Rings, you know, he basically set out to write a sequel to The Hobbit. And so he made some decisions with respect to the importance of the ring early on, and he needed to go back and update the story of Gollum, right,
okay.
to match his intention for the importance of the ring.
Right. Yes.
And so that's what a lot of phase four was concerned with, was the harmonization of the Lord of the Rings with the Hobbit in its second edition. And then phase five is what we're going to talk about here shortly. And this was something he took upon himself in 1960. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then the last phase laid out in Ratliff's book is phase six. And these are some edits requested in the mid 60s by the publisher.
Okay.
And those were basically, they needed him to make some changes to the text of The Hobbit in order to assert their copyright against these unauthorized editions that were being published in America, right?
Mm.
So they were very minor changes, and honestly, like, we're just not even going to bother looking at those, at least not anytime soon.
Okay.
So, but phase five is really fascinating. Phase five is, this is going to be fun. This is in the book, it's labeled the 1960 Hobbit, and that basically is because he wrote this in 1960, right? He set out to write the Hobbit in the style of the Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing. So why did he undertake this? Actually, I want you to read the bold questions when I touch you on the arm. Yeah.
Why did he undertake this?
How about you do it like this? So John, tell us, why did he undertake this?
Okay. So,
I'm annoying you.
So John, I'm very curious.
Yes.
He already had a perfectly good version of The Hobbit that was very successful, right? I mean, it's flying off the shelves. People loved it.
It was
they couldn't get enough.
By this point, yeah.
Yeah. But for some reason that wasn't good enough for Tolkien. I'm a little flabbergasted.
Yeah.
And a bit, you know, kind of, I don't know.
It
confused. Why did he undertake this project of rewriting The Hobbit in the style of The Lord of the Rings?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
You know, kind of longer than I would have asked it. But,
okay. Well, I just wanted to throw in some of my own thoughts.
Good.
Because, I mean, if it ain't broke, right? I mean, if people like it the way it is,
You're referring to The Hobbit, not the question.
I'm referring to The Hobbit, okay. Not the question.
Yeah, so so essentially, I think Tolkien always had some uneasiness with The Hobbit in hindsight, right?
Okay.
We see this even in his essay on fairy stories, right? Which was delivered shortly after the publication of The Hobbit. And in that story, he talks about how like fairy tales don't necessarily have to be like children's stories. And he kind of goes against the idea that like fairy tales need to be told in this kind of like nursery rhyme sort of way, like talking down to children. Okay. And his thoughts on that really developed and flowered in full, I think, for Lord of the Rings, right? Because that story even itself developed into something much grander. Okay. So we all know that The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, even though they tell one continuous story, are very different styles of books, right?
Yes.
One has more of a, it's not childish, but it definitely has passages that are kind of winking at you and that kind of thing in a very like talking down to you kind of way.
Yeah.
Whereas Lord of the Rings, just far more epic, doesn't really engage in any of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe here and there, but it's not as prevalent. So there's indications that Tolkien had always been unsatisfied with how The Hobbit was presented in it is a story overall.
Okay.
And he had, as we know from the last couple of episodes, he had spent some time developing the backstory of The Hobbit in order to support The Lord of the Rings, right? The story of The Lord of the Rings.
Right. Yeah.
So for the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at The Quest of Erebor from Unfinished Tales, which is a large part of his effort in the 50s to give the background on the reason the dwarves wanted to retake Erebor in the first place. How did they come to be kind of, you know, put out from there, and why were they going on this big mission to get back there, and how in the world did Bilbo come to be involved in it?
Got it.
Because when we read The Hobbit, right, when we read the original version of The Hobbit, it's just kind of like in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, and then he was hanging out one day, and then these dwarves showed up, right? Well, Gandalf showed up. And who's Gandalf? And then these dwarves showed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we don't get a lot of the background on how that came to be. But we get that in The Quest of Erebor. So he'd been thinking about this for some time. And we don't really know entirely why he decided in 1960 that he was going to rewrite The Hobbit, but he did, right?
Okay.
So apparently this was something that he had been, you know, thinking about, and, you know, he just made up his mind that he was going to do it and sat down to do it, and we have some of that now. So,
alrighty.
So that's how he came to undertake it, and he wanted to have The Hobbit fit that epic style and contextualize it to fit within the broader scope of the history of Middle Earth.
So he kind of wanted maybe a more cohesive, a more cohesive mythology.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay.
But also just style, like he wanted it to have to match better the style of the Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
makes sense.
So
did he finish it?
He did not.
He didn't.
Did not finish it, unfortunately.
Why not?
So like many, you know, well, I mean, ultimately who knows? He probably, I think Tolkien was, quite subject to, or quite prone to, the shiny object syndrome, right?
Seems like a lot of the creative types are.
I think that's true. I think that's very true. And he had so many interests in his life, but who knows? There's that Ratliff's book doesn't really go into why it was never completed. We don't have any indication of why he, like, did he just throw up his hands and like, this was ridiculous. There's no strong indication that that was the case.
Okay.
Something probably just came up and it got away from him and he never got back to it, right?
Okay.
Remember, this is 1960. He passed away in 1973. So, you know, yeah, he could have come back to it, but, you know, he was also at this point still hoping that the Silmarillion would be published in his lifetime, right?
Yeah.
But he was also revising that and, you know, all sorts of other projects. And then, you know, he was a pretty famous author at this point too. So I'm sure that there were lots of, you know, requests for his time and attention on various matters. So, and I believe he was still teaching, or at least he still had at least the passing hobby of the love of languages and those sorts of things.
Right.
So, you know, there's plenty of reasons why it might have gotten derailed. But Ratliff does quote Carpenter's biography to say that Tolkien had to restrain himself from rewriting the book in the mid-60s when he had to provide the phase six edits that were mentioned above. So that phase six of the publisher coming to him and saying, we need you to make some edits so that we can reassert our copyright to this.
Mm-hmm.
he went back and he looked at The Hobbit and he had to, like, I guess maybe he remembered but he didn't have the notes from 1960 at hand, and he had to restrain himself from rewriting it, at least according to Humphrey Carpenter, his biographer.
So he had to restrain himself.
He had to restrain himself,
because he needed to focus on the phase six edits.
Well, and I suppose he had other things he had to attend to as well.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that he lost interest. He just didn't really have the time or the bandwidth.
Well, later on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows why he didn't continue with it in 1960. Because as we'll see, as we go through this, we'll see he got through, you know, not a small amount, right? I mean, there was some significant progress made on it, you know.
So how much? How much progress did he make?
So he actually accomplished about a 50% revision of chapter one.
Okay.
Which is, of course, a very, you know, famous chapter. You know, we all know that's the chapter where it's an unexpected party.
All right.
The dwarves show up. Gandalf shows up. The dwarves show up. And shenanigans ensue. We get the backstory of why they're going on this mission in the first place. And there's a lot of really interesting changes that happen there. A lot of additional exposition that occurs.
Okay.
And then chapter two, there's a whole section that, you know, which is, of course, mainly focused on their interaction with the trolls, right? There's a whole section of just travel through the countryside, leaving the Shire before they even get to the part of the trolls, right? That he's inserted and created for that. So it's like a whole nother episode, like a whole nother, like, mini adventure before they even get to the trolls.
Okay.
Yeah, really cool, right?
Yeah, that is cool.
So, and then chapter three, he gives a little bit more. He didn't make a ton of progress in chapter three, but he did get, he did make some notes about, like, leading up into their coming to Rivendell and giving some more background on why Rivendell was special and that sort of thing. So, and then he added some timelines, itineraries, and revisions to for the rest of the text. And, you know, then it just kind of trails off after that. So
into
oblivion.
Okay. So what kind of jumped out to you when you were looking at the what he had completed of the revised edition? What kind of really jumped out? Like, what was kind of memorable or significant?
So the first thing I would say would be the style, right? So we talked a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Before, you know, the original Hobbit has more of that fairy tale, even kind of certain qualities of, like, a nursery tale, but not overall, it's not childish, but there's little notes of, like, winking asides and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more exposition, right? So a lot more exposition in chapter one.
What do you mean by exposition?
So
just
like
extra,
like, more like long paragraphs of just like background and that kind of thing.
Okay.
All right. So there's a lot about in chapter one, there's a much more significant portion on, like, who the Took side of the family is.
Okay.
And then we get a lot more on, like, Gandalf. Another thing that really stands out is that we begin to see him making these connections to the larger Middle-earth story all the way from the beginning of chapter one, right? So there's a comment. Bilbo makes a comment about the other shore, right, at one point, right?
Oh, like the Grey Havens?
Like, yeah, well, the Grey Havens and the other shore really being where the Grey Havens take you, right, which is to Elvenholm, right, to Valinor,
right.
Across the sea, right?
Right.
So there's this awareness that even Bilbo has, apparently, in chapter one, that there is this place across the sea, even if he's not sure it's actually real, if it's just something he was told stories about when he was younger.
Yeah,
There's lots of little connections like this. That helped to contextualize the story into the broader reach of the well-developed history of Middle-earth by this point.
Cool.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's also another really interesting thing is that the first three chapters have different names, right?
Oh, the titles of the chapters are different.
Yeah. Hmm. So chapter one, which of course in the original is An Unexpected Party, is called A Well-Planned Party. Right?
Oh.
Called A Well-Planned Party.
Okay.
So I don't know how I feel about that. I feel like An Unexpected Party is like a classic kind of title for that chapter, but
yeah, well planned. That's just a little too buttoned up for my taste.
That's kind of how I feel about it. But and nevertheless, that's what the chapter is called, right? So in the notes that we have,
okay.
Then chapter two is roast mutton in the original, and in now it's called The Broken Bridge, to refer to this new episode that he's inserted before they meet the trolls.
What he added? Oh,
right?
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and then chapter 3 is called was called A Short Rest, and it focused on Rivendell, and it's now called Arrival in Rivendell, right? So
it's interesting.
Yeah.
There's definitely a theme there. Like they're more, they're less what's the right word? They're more, I think, like to the point. Like they're less what's the word?
They're less whimsical, I think.
Yes, less whimsical. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, definitely less whimsical.
Well, and again, I think that goes back to the style, right? To you know, there's just this. I think he was in the process editing out a lot of the kind of like fanciful, flighty sort of feel of a lot of the, especially the early part of The Hobbit.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, for better or for worse, I don't know, right? Because that's kind of something that gives the tale its, you know, a certain flavor.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we can also understand that if he wanted to rewrite this in the style of The Lord of the Rings, then maybe that didn't have as much of a place anymore.
True. True.
So, and, or maybe he had just, you know, lost his appetite for roast mutton by this point. So
maybe. And that's mutton.
That's lamb, isn't it?
Is it lamb? I was going to say, I think it's lamb. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I'd agree. Like there's a whimsical feel to those three, kind of even like an open-ended feel to those titles. And then they feel much more like concrete direct in the revision.
Yes, I agree.
So
totally. Yeah.
Another thing I'd point out is that what I've already said about chapter 2, it contains several pages of additional material regarding the party's travel out of the Shire and in the wilderness preceding the episode with the trolls. So
right.
We already brought that up and won't go too far into that. Okay. We are going to look at chapter 2 and all of the, you know, we'll look at that whole section and have some fun kind of going through it and figuring out all the stuff we missed out on, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then we get a lot of notes about Tolkien's own concerns in the rewrite and the ideas he had for it.
Okay.
So even though we only get these three chapters, there's like lots of notes as he was wont to do, like questions he was asking himself, you know, that he felt like things that needed clarification or correction. And so we get an indication of where he hoped to go with this.
Okay.
Eventually.
Okay.
Right. And some of these things.
Cool.
So anyway, like it's just a totally fascinating topic. And I feel like as a fan, it leaves me with this big time catch 22 because I love The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
We all love The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most popular books of the 20th century. But, you know, I would agree with him that it feels so much different than Lord of the Rings. And I love Lord of the Rings more than anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I love Lord of the Rings more than anything. I wish I could have another book like Lord of the Rings that I felt the same way about as I do about Lord of the Rings, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Especially written by Tolkien himself.
Yeah.
And so it's just too much of a like crazy what might have been, you know, what if he had actually completed this and we would have it, right?
Yeah.
It kind of hurts to think about it, you know?
The longing of what might have been.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'll say, you know, I'll just go out, you know, kind of on a tangent here. I mean, I think I'd really, you know, I would love to have more adventures of Bilbo, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this recently with the, you know, who knows what the future holds for Tolkiendom and for, you know, the stories of Middle Earth, because if we're getting a whole TV series about the stories of the Second Age, and it's going to be like basically trying to tell stories that were never told by Tolkien himself, right? Or at least using just scraps of the basic outline of what he gave us. Who's to say we couldn't get further books from other writers who are anointed by, you know, the Tolkien estate to do so?
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
I mean, and that to me is another catch 22 because it's like, yes, I would so love there to be more story, like I would just love there to be more stories of Bilbo, right? Like more stories of the adventures he had. Because we hear about all these adventures he had after he came back from the Lonely Mountain all the way to the beginning of the Lord of the Rings, right? And I would just love to hear more about those stories. But there's so many other, there's just thousands of years of history that we don't have a lot of detail for.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would hate to be the writer that's well, on the one hand, you would love to be the writer, but you'd also hate to be the writer because you have to live up to this, like, I mean, who could ever think of like it's like if someone was like, yes, I can live up to the storytelling reputation of J.R.R. Tolkien, you're like, as soon as somebody says that to you, you're like, well, you're not the one.
Right. Exactly.
You know? Yeah. It would have to be somebody who's already proven themselves in some other regard to be able, you know, to tell really good stories. And it's like, no, I could never do that. And you would just have to beg that person, right? Like, and so, I don't know. It gets into this whole fascinating thing.
I just can't help but think. It's just like, the shoes are just too big. Like, they're too big.
Well,
I think
any writer worthy of that task would feel the same way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It would be a huge task.
And it would be really difficult to find somebody who could kind of like be that balancing act of like being true to Tolkien's vision, but telling, you know, continuing to tell like compelling stories, right?
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, I think there's this thing of like, he gave us the history, right? For the whole swath of from the first age to the end. So why can't there be more stories within that framework, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good question. Yeah, it's just a matter of finding just the right person to make it happen.
Or maybe different people, you know, maybe give different people a shot.
Different people.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It might be interesting just to see like a publication of just like a collection of short stories. There's like different writers taking a chance at it. Probably the most important thing is to have a good editor for all this stuff rather than just the writer.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, that's just an interesting topic. Like, I don't know how everybody else feels about that, but if you've got strong feelings on that one way or the other, we'd love to hear from you. That might be an interesting thing to talk about on a more extended version at some point. But yeah, so that's what we're going to be talking about over the course of the next few episodes, this 1960 Hobbit. And there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about in this. It's really worth taking our time and comparing the old, you know, comparing The Hobbit as in its published version with what might have been with these other chapters that we see.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
So, stay tuned. Stay tuned over the next couple of episodes. All right. Any questions you have right now, Greta?
No, that was really good. I found that quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited about these next few episodes as we get into this.
Yeah. It's going to be fun.
All right, well, let's look at some correspondence, shall we?
Yeah.
All right, well, first I want to start off with a really nice note we received from a listener and previous correspondent, Paige H. Paige writes and says, John and Greta, I wanted to drop another line, mostly to say thank you. First, thank you for your podcast collaboration on Leaf by Niggle. I got so much more out of that story after listening to your interpretation and discussion. I am a Protestant and appreciated the additional explanation of a Catholic worldview in listening to and reading the story. It is indeed a powerful tale with a beautiful message. Made my whole month.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Paige.
She said, would you and Greta be interested in breaking down some of Tolkien's other short stories on the podcast? I also read Farmer Giles of Ham, Roverandom, Smith of Wooton Major, and Adventures of Tom Bombadil and Tales of the Perilous Realm. So we definitely want to get to those. We've been saying that for years, I think, now, Paige. And, you know, it's probably something we need to just buckle down and do here soon. Maybe we'll even do it before we get into our long excursus, at least do one of those before we get into our long stretch on the history of the third age. But, yeah, there's definitely several other short stories. I think, for me, Leaf by Niggle just holds this incredibly, like, it's outside of the stories of Middle-earth, it's my favorite thing that Tolkien wrote, and every time I read it, it becomes more and more special to me. Even so much so that Greta got me like this really cool painting that's based on Leaf by Niggle for Christmas this year.
I just realized that you hung it up.
Yeah, I know, I'm slow about hanging.
No, I'm not.
It's been up there for several weeks.
Oh, and I'm just noticing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. In fact, it was noticed by somebody else who I was on a video chat with the other day. And
really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, friend Shell noticed it, and she thinks she might buy a copy of it, actually, for her. Yeah, okay. I mean, I need to make sure, and I'll try to link to that in the notes. It's this really great painting that that Greta found somebody who'd made of, and it's based on Leaf by Niggle. So
yeah, it is very pretty.
Yeah. All right, back to Paige's note here. Number two, thank you for your recent podcast, Tolkienian Spirit in Times of Crisis. It was uplifting to remember that we are not the only generation to face times like these. I only wanted to add that I also think of Yarendil and Elwing in the Silmarillion. Both were from displaced peoples. Elwing escaping the kinslaying that led to her father, Dior's death, and Yarindel fleeing from the fall of Gondolin to the forces of Morgoth. There was no reason to hope that their quest for Valinor and the pardon of the Valar would be any more successful than previous attempts. However, the image of Yarindel at the prow of his ship, holding the shining Silmaril aloft through the stormy seas, has come to my mind often as we stumble onward, not knowing what the future holds.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful thought there, Paige.
That is amazing. Yes, absolutely beautiful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
No, thanks so much for writing, Paige. It's great to hear from you. And, you know, please write us again soon and share some more awesome thoughts like that.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Wonderful to hear from you. And she says, onward. Onward indeed.
Yes. Yes and yes.
All right. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is just some correspondence that's been happening over on the website, TolkienRoad.com. And as I said, you can comment on previous episodes if you have something to say about a particular episode. In fact, let me just note that for a long time, I think there was an issue with the comments and where it made it hard. They didn't show up or something like that. So I apologize for that. I think there were some people who left comments and they never showed up. I fixed that. So all the comments are now showing over on the episode posts. You can also go all the way back to the beginning. For some reason, that was broken too, and it was harder to get back to the early episodes. So, you know, if you're listening now and wanted to comment, or if you go back and listen to earlier episodes, you can go back and comment on those episodes. So, I encourage you to do so. We'd like to keep the interaction going on past things.
Yeah.
It's always nice to hear about, like, remember things or, you know, episodes from the past that were a long time ago for us.
It really is. So, yeah.
But I wanted to mention there's a really interesting discussion happening on episode 188, which was the Mariner's Mailbag episode. It started with David Bigwood, who has written many times over the years for us. And he followed up on some comments made by one of our other listeners, Ty, one of the letters we read in that episode. And David said in response to Ty, he said, some very thoughtful and interesting letters. Ty asked some interesting questions that I don't think have any definitive answers. But if anyone wants to dig deeper into the afterlife of elves and men and their souls, Morgoth's Ring has useful texts. The main one is the Athrabeth Finrod Aondreth. In it, Finrod and a wise woman of the folk of Beor discuss the afterlife of both races. Earlier in the same book are the short texts of death and the severance of the Fea and Hrando, and the of rebirth and other dooms of those that go to Mondos. The text Azanwe Kenta in Vinyar Tingvar, Volume 39, has some information on the spirit and free will, as well as thought transmission. He said, Ty won't find an answer in any of those texts, but much to ponder. So,
Okay.
So that's really fascinating. This, you know, eschatology has always been a fascinating topic when it comes to Tolkien for me. Like, just there's a lot of interesting things in the Silmarillion, little interesting hints dropped here and there that aren't very well developed, but it's really cool to know that there's these particular things. And it's definitely something I want to spend some time with in the future. Like, you know, what are the fates of, like, the elves? Even just beyond going to the House of Mondos when they perish in battle, like, what is the ultimate fate of elves, like, at the end of history, right? In Tolkien's mind, right?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting question of itself. In response to that, I've encouraged some other people who've written me with similar, you know, similar thoughts, similar themes, to go over and participate in this discussion. And so one of those was Keith M. He said, your mention of the Athrabeth Finrod, and he's responding, I believe, to David here. Your mention of the Athrabeth Finrod, Aondreth, raises some interesting questions about the eschatology of Arda. As far as I can tell, JRRT apparently wanted the Athrabeth included as an appendix to the Silmarillion, and yet Christopher chose to leave it out. That and some other editorial decisions made by Christopher seem to me to seriously affect the eschatology of Arda. For example, the final paragraphs of The Voyage of Yarindel and The War of Wrath at the end of the published Silmarillion differ quite substantially from the ending of the 1936 Quintus Silmarillion. A number of paragraphs, particularly those including the second prophecy of Mondos, have been removed and a conclusion taken from the older form of the Vala Quinta inserted. The idea of Arda restored, which is communicated so beautifully in the second prophecy of Mondos, remained a continuous theme from the Book of Lost Tales, where it exists only in notes to the Quinta Noldorinwa to the Quinta Silmarillion. It is consistent with what Ilúvatar says in response to Melkor in the published version of the Ainul Lindale. No theme may be played that hath not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempteth this shall prove but mine instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined. The ending that includes the second prophecy of Mondos also seems to be quite consistent with what Tolkien writes about the Eucatastrophe in his essay on fairy stories. He writes, "Far more important is the consolation of the happy ending. Almost I would venture to assert that all complete fairy stories must have it." A few sentences later, the Eucatastrophic tale is the true form of fairy tale and its highest function.
Oh, sorry, I was just stretching.
Oh, okay. I thought you tapped me on the shoulder.
Oh, no.
The second prophecy of Mondos is the Eucatastrophe in the most amazing way imaginable. Turin Turambar, who suffers so much grief, deals the death blow to Morgoth, avenging the children of Húrin and all men. The Othrabeth, as you know, has a fascinating speculation about what Ilúvatar will eventually do to restore Arda. A Silmarillion that keeps the old ending with the second prophecy of Mondos and the Othrabeth seems to me to be much more in line with JRRT's view of the world and of the purpose of fairy tales, which he spent decades trying to perfect. By removing the second prophecy of Mondos and by not including the Othrabeth, Christopher's published Silmarillion ends on a much more somber and agnostic note, more along the lines of Norse mythology. We all owe Christopher Tolkien an enormous debt of gratitude for the decades of work he put in, making so much of his father's writing available, but I'm somewhat inclined to think he might have made a mistake in altering the ending found in the 1930 and 1936 versions. Do you think I'm wildly off on this? And then to round it all off, Ty comes back, and he says, "Not at all, you're wildly off in my opinion. Sadly, I don't believe we shall ever know why this decision was made either. In a world with so many knowns, it is the fact of so many unknowns which will fuel Tolkien discussions for ages to come." So I think this is just a real, like, there's so much in there for me to learn. Like, these folks have done a really, like, they've done a lot more research into these topics than I have. And I thank them for that and for sharing that knowledge with me. And now I'm like, okay, add to my reading list these topics from, you know, various sources in Tolkien lore. And, you know, I hope we do eventually get to a series of episodes on this topic. Yeah. I think it would be really fascinating. I agree with Keith that idea of, like, Turin dealing the death blow in some kind of last battle to Morgoth is like the ultimate consolation of the happy ending, right? Like that, just the, because you think of Turin as like this character who just, like, his life is just utter misery and in so many different ways. And, it's a story, you know, when we do eventually get around to doing the Children of Húrin, that we'll have to talk much more about the significance of that story and what it all means. But it's a beautiful thought to think of Turin, like, kind of having the final word in that regard. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to give Morgoth his comeuppance. So.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's good stuff. Can I ask real quick, Morgoth's, sure. Who David mentioned Morgoth's Ring.
Yes.
Is that a book?
It's one of the history of, it's the title of one of the history of Middle Earth.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
And it's interesting. Yeah, it's a very, like, ooh, what's that all about? Morgoth had a ring?
Mm-hmm.
I think it actually, Morgoth's ring actually refers to, like, Arda was his ring, right?
Got it. So, got it. Yes. Okay.
You know, it was this thing that he was always trying to take possession of.
Got it.
So.
Makes sense. Okay.
But, you know, this is just, it's great. This is great discussion because it reminds you of how much, as much as you might think you know about Middle Earth, and here we are almost 200 episodes into this podcast, and there's still so much more to discover. So,
yeah.
Exciting stuff.
It is. It really, really is.
So thank you guys for that discussion. And I encourage anybody who's interested in that topic to go over and read those comments and, you know, follow up with the discussion if you'd like to participate in it and keep it going. So.
Yeah.
All right. Greta, any final thoughts for this week?
No, I'm excited. Like, I'm excited about, you know, diving in.
Cool.
To the actual chapters of the Lost Hobbit.
Right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you.
Don't forget to correspond via TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, Facebook, Twitter. Leave us a comment over on the website. So
yes,
any of those ways is fine.
Or all of them.
Next week, we'll continue with the history of The Hobbit, looking at the Chapter 1 revisions and having some fun with that. And we want to give a shout out to our $5 patrons. Eric B.
Daniel P.
David B.
Chuck F.
Ish of the Hammer.
Chris L.
James L.
Zeke F.
James A.
Emilio P.
Shannon S.
Teresa C.
Azia V.
And Brian O.
Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you guys.
And thank you to all our patrons as well. And to all of our listeners.
Yeah, you keep us going.
We will talk at you next time.
Yes, we will.
Bye-bye.
Bye, y'all.